I'm Tom Reaney, host of Jazz on the Mode here on New England Public Radio. And my guest today is Benny Golson, the renowned saxophonist and composer, and the author now of a newly published memoir, an autobiography from Temple University Press. It's called Whisper Not, the Autobiography of Benny Golson. Benny, it's a real pleasure and honor to welcome you here today to New England Public Radio. Thanks for joining us.
Tom's reciprocal. I've been looking to this, to talking with you. I've heard about you. You're famous.
Thank you, Benny. You know, I want to begin by saying that the very first interview I ever did with a musician was with Art Farmer. It was nearly...
Oh, my goodness.
it was nearly 40 years ago, and I have to say, Benny, it was an auspicious beginning for me because Art made me feel good about the job I'd done interviewing him. He even invited me to come down to the city to hear him at the Blue Note. I sat at his table with the Reverend John Gensel. It was a really a beautiful experience. And of course, you and Art made a lot of great music together back in the day, and I wonder what you recall of him today.
First thing I ever heard from him in 1953, he was already with a member of Lionel Hampton's band, and when I joined, that's when I met him. First thing that impressed me was the sound that he got from that trumpet. Incredible. Incredible. Unheard of. Other guys had to play the flugelhorn to get that sound. He got it from the trumpet. That was it. And then his knowledge of intervals, how he constructed his solos. He's an intelligent man, musically.
You worked with Lionel Hampton, and Art was on that band, and so many other players, soon to be great players, were part of that Lionel Hampton orchestra too. Can you tell me how it was that just a couple of the footsteps that you had taken in life that brought you from Philadelphia to working with Lionel Hampton?
Well, you know, word of mouth. By word of mouth, your reputation gets around because up to that point, you know, you're an amateur and then you're a novice and then you get a little better. So you have no recordings to refer to. So it's all word of mouth. Have you heard that tenor player from Cincinnati? So and so and so and so. And it begins like that. And what happened, I was playing in Atlantic City for the summer, and that was mostly shows and dance music like that. But Quincy Jones, who was with Lionel Hampton at the time, they were in the area, and they had some time off, so they came to see the show. And they heard me, and they heard a fellow named Clifford Brown, who was also in the group, mm-hmm. and a fellow named G.G. Grice. Mm-hmm. And I think Lionel needed some musicians at that time. I don't know exactly what the situation was. Maybe they were leaving, or they got fired. I don't know. But he recommended the three of us. And that's how I joined the band. Yeah, and that's when I found out that Art Farmer, well, I didn't know him. That's when I met him. Mm-hmm. And of course, Lionel Hampton, having Clifford Brown and Art Farmer in the band, he set up these so-called battles of the trumpet every night. You know, it was wonderful.
That was Hamp's style in so many ways, competition and entertainment.
Right. And he never wanted to finish. You know, the show was over, and they were closing the curtains, and he was still trying to play, and they're closing the curtains on him. He just wanted to play. And he could play, really.
Indefatigable, I call him.
That's right, and capable of being pleased.
Well, let's just stay with that outfit with Hamp for a moment. And Clifford Brown, who, you know, obviously meant the world to you and that motivated you in the tragedy of his death.
Yeah, he was a dear friend.
Yeah.
I still miss him, Tom.
Mm-hmm.
I still miss him. A lovely young man. His life was snuffed out at 25 years of age. He was still ascendant.
Yes, certainly ascendant. And that was 60 years ago, you're recalling now, Benny, that you still miss... Brown Immortal, as you've called him. You composed, I remember, Clifford, probably the most famous memorial or elegy that we have in jazz. How did that come about?
It came about because of his death, Tom. Mm-hmm. And I always say I wish I hadn't written it. And what I mean by that, I wish he hadn't been killed.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. But when he was killed, I felt that I had to write it. I had to remind people of this 25-year-old genius. But little did I know, he didn't need any help from me. The legacy that he left behind after the fact was just as important as if he were still here. But what people don't know is how he was as a person. He never bragged about anything that he did. He always made a big sensation about other people. Did you hear what he played in the bridge to Cherokee? Did you notice what he did on the fifth bar when he made the so-and-so-and-so? Mm-hmm. And you'd think that, well, yeah, this guy's a student, until he put that trumpet up to his mouth and he became somebody else. He became a tiger in the forest, or the world's greatest lover. That's the way he was.
Wow. Beautifully said. Evoking Clifford Brown. You know, I have to say, Benny, that the memoir itself, from start to finish, is amazingly detailed and vivid and evocative. There are just so many points in this, in your autobiography, that you recall with such a richness of detail and emotion that you're still able to bring to, well, like you just did with your memory of Clifford Brown. But one of the things that I noted right away, of course, is that the book begins discussing your friendship with John Coltrane, and right there on the day that you learned of Coltrane's death in 1967.
I was I got my horn when I was 14, and I knew absolutely nothing. But I met him when I was about 16. He was 18, yeah. Mm-hmm. And we were together almost every day. He lived in an apartment, and fortunately, I lived in a house, a three-story house, and we had a living room. And it was during the summer, so the windows were up and the screens were in. Now, before he joined me, as a rank beginner, all the neighbors could hear me, and all the neighbors wanted to kill me. Then he joined me as a budding amateur, and they wanted to kill two people, but we both got better. Hmm. We got better as time went by. My mother, and the reason I knew it, my mother would go to the market, and nobody called me Benny during that time. I was Junior, and she'd go to the market, and the neighbors would say, "Does Junior know how to play Don't Blame Me? Can he play Stardust? Can he play Night and Day?" And so what we did, we learned those tunes, and they put up with all the other nonsense.
You say that John Coltrane was restless. He was a searcher. And you say he reached...
Oh, from the beginning, yeah. He was never satisfied, even late into his career. He was a searcher, yeah. A musical archaeologist.
Yeah, you say that he reached for musical perfection and artistic excellence in absolutes.
Yeah, and he had the ability, see. He was ahead of the rest of us. He and Jimmy Heath. Mm. Jimmy Heath was ahead of both of us in the beginning. Mm-hmm. I still tell him today, and he's 90 years old now, "I'm still waiting for you to make a mistake." Yeah, but it was like an adventure, Tom. But we weren't searching for live game. We were searching for new concepts, new ideas, extrapolations, new ways to do the old thing. You know, what's out there? And we wanted to open the doors along the corridor, the metaphoric corridor. We wanted to open doors and see what was behind those doors. So it was like an adventure.
Mm-hmm.
And since no one really knows everything, Tom, the adventure continues. I'm an old guy now. And I'm still involved in that same adventure. When I wake up, intuitively, I think, what can I do better today than I did tomorrow? So that's like an engine, and it propels us forward. That gives us so-called forward motion.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's an adventure.
Mm-hmm. Part of the adventure that you convey in the book is about your boyhood in Philadelphia. And I love the stories of, you know, what it was like growing up without a lot of riches, without a lot of comfort, with the basic security of your mother's love and her home, and mm-hmm. the challenge of a home that had a leaky roof and indifferent and hostile landlords.
And
oh yeah, oh yeah. No, these to me, Benny, are the priceless details of memoir and of narrative and of each of our lives. And I was particularly struck by the detail of the number of coal bins that you said were in families' basements.
Oh, my goodness.
And what you could tell about a family in terms of how many bins were filled on the day of a delivery.
That's right. You know, usually people got, in our neighborhood, you just got one bin. And the coal trucks that came in, they'd come in and they'd raise the truck up on an angle so that the coal could slide out on a chute into the bin in the cellar. We had the little windows beneath the regular windows in the living room, which entered into the basement. Mm-hmm. And everybody usually got one of those areas from the truck. But when they came and they got three areas, that was like a status symbol. And, you know, living like that on welfare and things like that, it didn't bother me at all. And the reason it didn't bother me, I didn't know about the other kind of life. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't missing anything. I didn't know. I wasn't able to enjoy it and miss it because I never had it and didn't know about it. So I was happy as a lark, you know, with holes in my shoes and holes in the knickers and whatnot. Yeah, it didn't bother me. That was not a setback.
Mm-hmm.
But only later, in retrospect, when I was able to leave that, and look back at the whole thing, I was able to say, now, wasn't that something? Why did I continue with that? Mm-hmm. I continued because I didn't know about anything else. And that was like a form of protection, I guess, your personality and your will to move forward and your determination, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And all of us, there were so many poor kids. There were more kids than rich kids, believe me, black and white.
Mm-hmm. Sure. It sounds as though you were in what I would call the nucleus of not just a family and a home, but a community. And your description of the community, from the leaky roof and the coal bins, but also to friends and some of the life-changing, life-learning experiences. Another that comes to mind is Wilbert Butler, a neighborhood...
Well, you really did read.
the neighborhood kid with perfect diction. What did he teach you?
Oh, it did start out like that. He was like the rest of us,
right.
You know, leaving off the INGs.
Mm-hmm.
And then he started adding that, and we said, boy, he's talking funny. And really, he was using correct English. And we thought... He's beginning to sound like the white people. Who does he think he is? Yeah. And I thought I was some sort of food Superman, I guess. And even though he was a large guy, I was kind of a bully. And he was getting older, both of us were getting older, and he went away for summer vacation. And when he came back, he was of a different mind. And he said to me, I think I put that in the book, do you remember how you used to pick on me? And I said, mm-hmm. He said, you want to try it now? And I looked at him, and he said that with so much intensity that I said, mm-hmm. And he later went on to become a policeman. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Wilbert
yeah.
Butler, right across the street from me.
Right. Your book also has an amazing description of the night that you met the lady who was to become your wife. Bobby Heard, it's one of the most vivid and evocative descriptions of that kind of experience in life that I've ever read. I think most men know what it is to go weak in the knees, as you put it, but you bring it to a whole new level. And
oh, yes, I'd heard that for all of my young life.
Right.
And I thought it was just the same, you know, hyperbolizing.
Right.
But when I saw her, I had to lean against the piano because I felt my legs were not going to support me. Yeah, I said, darn, I'll be darned. It's true.
Yeah,
that was a turning point in my life.
Where did that happen, Benny?
I've been married to her for 57 years. And let me tell you, yeah, I was like other guys. I guess I was out there on the road and women and this and that. But when I married her 57 years ago, I never touched another woman because I felt that I had the prize. Why take a sandwich to a banquet? I had the banquet, so there was no need.
I'm sure you've heard that line by Paul Newman, why eat hamburger when you've got steak at home?
That's the same thing. That's right.
You said that you said that in meeting Bobby, you felt as if God gave her to me out of infinite kindness.
That's exactly what I felt. And you instinctively, metaphorically, symbolically, yeah.
Where were you playing when you met her?
Washington, D.C., her home.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit more about that night. How did it happen?
That night, I was there with the Jazz Messengers. We had a two-week engagement. And Bobby had become friends with a girl named Ann Jeter. And Ann Jeter's friend was Bobby, and he had invited her. Bobby Timmons had invited Ann to the club. But during that time, we could only have one guest. And she didn't want to come by herself, so she was going to bring her friend, which was Bobby. And he said to me, "Can you come to the door with me? Ann is bringing a friend, and I want you to accept her as your friend." Of course, I didn't know who she was.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went to the door, and Ann came in. And it wasn't too much light there, and I wasn't paying any attention. I wasn't really concerned. And I said, "Oh, yeah, she's my guest." And she came in, and that was it. And, of course, we were on intermission. And then we went back on the bandstand. I looked down, and on the first row, first table there, was Ann and this girl. And I said to Bobby, "Who is that with Ann?" He said, "That's the girl you let in." Wow. And that's when my legs got weak. And at that moment, I saw myself marrying her, getting the kids off to school, washing dishes for all. It was crazy.
Wow.
But she became my wife.
Mm-hmm. And you still adore her and cherish her every day.
Adore her, I'm telling you. I wouldn't change her for all the tea in China.
Mm.
She's the one. She is the one and the only one.
Mm. Well, I wish you many more happy days and years together. That is really one of the most compelling stories I've read in a long time of that kind of experience of the meeting of two people and the discovery of love and what you call... you said that she took up residence in your heart right away.
That's right. She didn't even know I existed. Yeah, I had to do a lot of talking. I asked her for a phone number, and she told me to go look in the telephone book. Oh. And I said, "Who does she think she is? Forget her." That next morning, I was staying at a rooming house. I was up at 6 o'clock in the morning, out on the street looking for a phone booth to find a telephone book.
Beautiful man. Hard to get is worth every ounce of effort, you know.
Yeah, those were the days.
Mm. There's another great and really powerful passage in the book when you talk about going to see Lionel Hampton, whom we've already mentioned, at the Earl Theater in Philadelphia. It was a life-changing experience. You called it a pregnant moment, and it involved Arnett Cobb and flying home. And can you bring us back to that moment today?
Yes. I became interested in music, the piano particularly, at age 9, and that's when I began taking piano lessons. And I was working assiduously at it. And by 12, my piano teacher, I had a little repertoire. I wasn't great, you know, it's just a piano student. He'd send me from time to time to play these black bourgeois women afternoon tea, Sunday afternoon. I don't really think anybody was listening to me. It was just the music was going.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a time for me to practice, really. But I was serious. I thought I was going to be a concert. Well, I wanted to be a concert pianist, and I was going in that direction. Until I was 14 when I heard Lionel Hampton at the Earl Theater. And when Arnett Cobb stepped out there and the microphone came up out of the floor and he started playing that solo on Flying Home, that's when the piano began to fade that day.
Wow.
Even though I continued to play the piano because it was mandatory throughout college, my heart was in the saxophone.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's what happened.
Mm-hmm. Had you heard the record of Flying Home by that time?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, I'd heard it. But I really wasn't drawn to it, listening to it on a recording. But seeing the curtains open, because I got there, the show hadn't begun. And when the show began, the band started playing with the curtain closed and the spotlight on the curtain. I didn't know what to expect. I didn't know it. And as the curtain opened slowly, I saw the first line saxophone. And, of course, the spotlights made them sparkle. Then the trumpets behind them, the trombone, and off to the left, the piano and the bass over there and the drums. Oh, I was awe-inspired. You know, it was the first time it really just took me over completely. And when Arnett Cobb stepped out there and played that solo, I was screaming like you used to hear about the Beatles. The girls used to come here, the Beatles, and scream through everything. I was screaming.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, you said in the book that you almost cried shamelessly with joy.
Yes. I mean, I'd never heard anything that touched me that way.
Mm.
None of the classical things touched me that way.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that touched me in the deepest way.
Sure.
Yeah, there was more to come.
Right.
Much more to come. Much, much more to come. Yeah.
You spent
my
life.
My life's pursuit, yeah.
Mm. You spent some time in the book recalling another legend of the saxophone and a player who I know was very popular back in the day and renowned as a great saxophone virtuoso, but he's hardly mentioned anymore, and that's Earl Bostick. Why do you think Earl Bostick is, you know, not so prominent anymore?
He was prominent in the kind of music that he played, but he didn't play the kind of music that really exhibited his real ability.
Mm.
He was a technician on that horn, but he didn't go that route. Because I remember when Arnett Cobb out and played that, came out to the front of the stage and played that solo on Flying Home, that was one thing. And when he came out, Earl Bostick came out, and he played what we call snakes all over the horn.
Yep.
Difficult. And he got just a slight applause.
Oh.
And Arnett came out and said, "Ooh," and everybody just went crazy. It was one of those things, yeah. But he wanted to go the route where he could make some money. But this guy could do, he played above the range of the horn. He could sight read. He could read a trumpet part if there was no part for him.
Mm.
He could play and breathe at the same time so it could sound like he wasn't taking a breath. He could, and I asked him, "How did you get like that?" He was from Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm.
He said, "When I was a student, I started my practice at 8 in the morning. 5 in the evening, like a job. I took a break at 12 for lunch.
Wow.
And I took Sunday off." He said, "That's what I did every day." Wow, nobody did that.
Mm.
Incredible.
Mm-hmm.
And he had the talent and ability to go along with that. So it paid off in a big way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. He was he was unusual, quite unusual.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't pursue that ability to make money. He played, what was his name? Song. Flamingo.
Flamingo, yeah.
We played Flamingo. I was throwing up. I played that song so much with him.
Oh, dear.
But that's how he made his money, Flamingo.
And Harlem Nocturne.
Harlem Nocturne. Boy, yeah, you got it all together.
How about,
right, that's it.
You know, I just listened to his recording again this morning of Cherokee.
He played that too. Earl Bostick was something. We played a gig in Baltimore. And he pulled out his clarinet. I didn't even know he could play clarinet, the jam session. And he played Cherokee on that darn clarinet.
Wow.
And Cherokee, well, was a difficult song during that time because we hadn't become proficient enough to really sparkle on. And it was kind of fast, you know. You showed how good you were for how fast you played it. He played all over that clarinet on Cherokee. That guy was superb.
Mm-hmm.
And before I played with him, John Coltrane played with him. And he was telling me how he was. And I joined him, sure enough. Earl Bostick, he was a killer.
Mm-hmm. Sonny Rollins is the only artist, I think he's the only artist besides John Coltrane whom you call a genius.
That's right. Styles were completely different, going in different directions. But each had a great deal to say in his own way. Charlie Parker used to say, he used to play with amateurs sometimes. I mean, he'd find him playing in situations where you wouldn't expect to find him. He said, "Everybody has something to say."
Mm-hmm.
And that's true. You say it in this way, he says it in that way. And his is great and yours is not, and his is maybe. but they say what they can say to the full extent of what they can say. And hopefully they'll progress and they'll get better. But you have to have talent more than desire. If you don't have the talent to take you along, then it's academic.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen that happen. Three or four people come out of Philadelphia. They wanted to play in the worst way, but they didn't have the ability. They didn't have the comprehension. They didn't have all the things that you needed to move ahead.
Mm-hmm.
They had the new horns. They had the goatee and the berets that they were wearing, the
sure.
hip berets, like the front. Oh, but they didn't have the talent.
Mm-hmm.
And that was sad to see that happen. Yeah, that happens sometimes.
Sure. Oh, yeah. In that chapter on Sonny Rollins, you say any serious jazz musician must exemplify two forms of originality, of sound and of expressive style. I'd love to hear you break down the difference between those two, between sound and expressiveness.
Sound is the sound that you get. And sometimes it's more than the mouthpiece. The mouthpiece helps you. But the sound doesn't begin with the mouthpiece that you put on the horn. The sound begins in your head, in your mind. And you're trying to come up, even if it's intuitive, but that sound that you hear in your mind and symbolically in your heart. And you can play the sound, same mouthpiece as Charlie and James, but get a different sound from it. Because everything with the mouth is intuitively taking you in that direction, how you open your throat, different things. And you do these things intuitively, because intuitively you're trying to get that sound that's in your head.
Mm-hmm.
So it's more than the mouthpiece. And what was the other thing?
Well, expressiveness.
Yeah, when you play in the beginning, you're eclectic. You don't have anything to draw upon. You don't have any money in the bank to withdraw. You have nothing. You don't have any money. You don't have any talent. So you're eclectic. You're sounding like John, and you're sounding like Harry and Lewis until you begin to get the feeling together what it's all about, and you begin to develop your own feeling and your own style. So you're not sounding like Coleman Hawkins or Ben West or Lester Young. You're sounding like whomever you are.
Mm-hmm.
And that takes time. In the beginning, you're sounding like everybody. You're imitating piano players, guitar players. You're trying to get it together. And when you finally come to understand it, you're developing what you have already heard as far as the sound in your head. And ability takes you further as you go along. And you begin to develop and unleash things that are in your own heart. And that's what you want to do. You don't want to make somebody else famous by playing what they play. You hear a guy playing with great proficiency and he's sounding like so-and-so, and then you say to yourself, I wonder what does he sound like? I hear him sounding like so-and-so, and it takes great ability to play like that. But with that kind of ability, why is he sounding like himself? Why is he giving glory to that guy? You know, right now there are lots of people, yeah, lots of musicians, who try to play John Coltrane. He had that kind of influence.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote a letter to one, I'm not going to mention any name, and he's a professional saxophonist and great ability. Why are you wasting your time trying to sound like John Coltrane? People are only interested in diamonds, not the zircons. You're bringing glory to him. What about you?
Mm-hmm.
Don't you want people to know your sound? Don't you want people to know your heart? Don't you want people to know your musical inclination and your disposition? Why are you doing that? That's a waste of time.
Mm-hmm. In your chapter on Coleman Hawkins, you reflect on what I read as a kind of sense of the negative impact that critics can have. And I think it was probably more the case back in your youth when critics exerted more influence or importance around people's tastes and directions that the public went in. But there you expressed some frustration that you were continually mentioned, you know, it's in a kind of Don Byas, Lucky Thompson lineage that
right.
people, you know, said you sounded like you were influenced by John Coltrane. And do you recall reading any critics, let's say jazz critics, just to narrow it down, whose work you've enjoyed or you felt reflected, you know, something that you felt was more accurately a reflection of yourself, of your own objectives.
Yes, and there were many.
Oh.
But the one that stands out as the critic was Nat Hentoff. He is a political reporter, I think. He writes for the Wall Street Journal now.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
But he used to be a jazz critic.
Mm-hmm.
And the mistake that many of the jazz critics made during that time, they gave you their opinion. But there are millions of opinions. The world is filled with opinions. But they're supposed to go at it from another angle, not just an opinion, what the music really is, what it grows out of, where it's going, how it's affecting people, how it affects the one playing it. Yeah, sometimes they neglect it to get into that realm of it. So all they were giving you was an opinion.
Right.
And you could ask the guy next door his opinion too. But he's not to be he's not a so-called critic. But the critics should come with more than an opinion. They should be able to evaluate the music properly because of what they hear. Place it here, place it there. And some of them were in error. Sometimes it was just an opinion sometimes. One wrote an article about me in Downbeat. That was a long time ago. Oh, he put me down to the ground. And I called Downbeat and asked him, could I write a rebuttal? And they said yes. And I wrote, and I'm sure it embarrassed him, but he was way out of line. It was just full of opinion, you know, and that's not the role of a critic.
Mm-hmm.
A critic should be probative, you know, not just an opinion.
Right.
I like his sound. Well, God, Charlie can tell me that next door. I like his sound or I don't. Tell me more. But Nat Hentoff. And there were others, too, that were great, of course. I don't remember all the names.
Mm-hmm.
But back during that time, he was the one that stood out to me as the critic.
Mm-hmm. I read, you know, everything I could get my hands on by Nat. And he was, I think, exceptional in open-mindedness, curiosity, and bringing alive something of the personality, the character of musicians. I feel like I began to get a feeling for Charles Mingus. And for, you know, many of the musicians that Nat wrote about. And, you know,
yeah.
I appreciate hearing you mention Nat. As I say, I've read him, you know, religiously over the years.
He's a great guy, and he's well-informed, even in the area that he's in now, the Wall Street Journal.
Right, right.
Yeah, he knows what's going on, and it takes time to find out.
Mm-hmm. He grew up in Boston, and... that leads me to another interesting thing here regionally. I'm a Bostonian in my own background, and I, you know, I was aware of this, but I was happy to see you mention in the chapter of your memoir "Whisper Not" that you devote to talking about your work as a composer, talking about how you basically got a commission to write "Stablemates" through Herb Pomeroy and a Boston. Scene. Can you take us back to that?
Yeah, actually, I'd written it before he asked about it.
Ah, uh-huh.
And that's another whole story. But the title came from where he used to work. The
sure.
club he worked in was called The Stables. And it was strange. It was on Commonwealth, that street Commonwealth.
Commonwealth,
and it was a ritzy ditzy hotel, a restaurant. But you know, the waiters with the towels on the arms, and, but you went to the back of the high-class restaurant, and you went downstairs, and in the basement was this club, the Stables,
right.
where they played jazz. Herb Pomeroy, Vardy Hartitzian on the tenor, John Nez on bass, Chitano, I think was the piano player, I can't remember, but I used to sit in with him, because I went through Boston quite a bit with Earl Bostic. We played Revere Beach and Holyoke and Peabody and all those surrounding places.
Really?
So we were there a lot, and I got to know the group, and he knew that I was a composer. And I had written this oddball tune that I eventually called Stablemates because of Herb.
Mm-hmm.
Stablemates mean that all the horses are in the stable, and they're together.
Sure.
Symbolically, Stablemates means friends.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's how I came up with the title.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful. I know the recording of it that Herb made. I feature it you know, oftentimes around Herb's birthday observance and all in my program here on New England Public Radio. But and I knew Herb a little bit, too. I had the pleasure of hearing him many times and interviewing him and talking about Duke Ellington at length. And I wonder if you... You just mentioned Holyoke with Earl Bostick. That's a nearby city here to Springfield.
Yeah, yeah.
I just heard about a venue there recently, and someone mentioned Earl Bostick as a regular attraction, and Lionel Hampton, too, was a regular at that venue in Holyoke, so that's nice to hear.
Well, I'm not sure about Lionel Hampton, but I played Holyoke many times with Earl Bostick. I guess they liked him.
Really? Wow, many times, huh?
And people, yeah, many times.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's why I was in Boston playing with the Herb Pomeroy on the Days Off.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah. Incidentally, John Coltrane eventually took that same tune to Miles Davis when he joined him. And when Miles spoke to me, he asked me, said, "What were you smoking when you wrote that?" Yeah, it was kind of out there, the structure.
Yeah, it's beautiful, too. I think that was almost the first tune that Miles recorded with the quintet.
Well, it's the first tune he ever recorded of mine that put me on the map, so to speak, because I'm embarrassed when I think about it. I mean, I used to meet people prior to that, shake their hands and give them a tune. Did anything ever happen? Nothing. When John took it to him and he recorded it, and people saw the title and my name underneath, and they, wait a minute, is this the guy that gave me the tune? And they're feeling in their breast pocket and under the rug and in the trash can. Yeah, it's the same guy. Mm-hmm. And then they started recording my tunes. Well, if Miles is recording Stable Mates by him, let me look at these other tunes. He must be into something. Miles is recording this stuff. And that's what got me started as a jazz composer.
Sure.
And my dear friend John, who took it to New York.
Mm-hmm.
That's what got me started, Tom.
Yes. Yeah. And you worked with Dizzy Gillespie around that time, who, did he make the first recording of Whisper Not?
Let me see, I'm trying to remember now. It was either him or Lee Morgan.
Yeah.
I think it was Dizzy.
Yeah.
Because I wrote that tune in about 20 minutes, Tom.
Really?
And I said, nobody writes a tune in 20 minutes. This tune can't be worth anything. But he heard it, and he liked it.
Oh,
and I did an arrangement of it, and we played it, and he eventually recorded it.
Yeah. It's a beautiful song.
So, and then other people started to record it. And you never know. People say, oh, Benny Golson, you know, he writes these memorable tunes. When I write those tunes and when I write any tune, Tom, I don't have the slightest idea what's going to happen with that tune. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, I'd get up, yawn, eat breakfast, and go down and write a hit tune.
Right.
Doesn't happen like that.
Right.
The way it happens, you write a tune, and the people tell you what they think of it.
Mm-hmm.
They buy the recordings. They come to hear you play it. They talk about the tune.
Mm-hmm.
The musicians start to play it. That's when you know what you've got. Not when you're sitting there with pencil and paper in hand and putting the notes on paper. You know absolutely nothing. My wife told me Killer Joe would never make it. She said it's too darn monotonous. She heard those two chords, predominant chords, from 9 o'clock in the morning to 9 o'clock that night. She was about to throw up. When I asked her what does she think of it, she said, it'll never make it. And I told my audiences, after about 3 or 4 coats, she changed her mind.
3 or 4 coats, right. What a hit.
Yeah.
That was I think that was the first Benny Golson tune I ever heard. It was on Quincy Jones' record. I think it was called Walking in Space.
That's right.
And man, that really got our attention. We were teenagers at the time and just beginning to explore. And there it was. You know, you're reminding me of an interview I just found with Louis Armstrong. CBS News 1970, Armstrong took exception to the way the reporter phrased a question, and he gave him a piece of his mind. And one of the things that the reporter says is, why do you think you're so, you know, popular or something like that? Or you know, what do you account for your genius? And Armstrong says, ask the public.
Good.
They'll tell you why.
Well, he was popular, boy, believe me.
Oh, man, yeah. I love that answer, though. Ask the public.
And I think of the night when he and Clifford Brown played together.
No kidding.
Never recorded. It was a pity. Yeah, I was playing Atlantic City for the summer with Pat Dameron.
Mm-hmm.
But it was mostly the show music we were playing and dance music for the people afterwards. It was that kind of a gig. Every now and then we'd play a jazz tune here and there. But Louis Armstrong came in one night, and Tad knew him. And Tad said, why don't you come on and sit in and play a tune with us? Now, let me tell you who was in the band. Tad was the leader. He played piano.
Mm-hmm.
Philly Joe was a drummer. Jimmy Murray was a bass player. Gigi Grice played alto. Cecil Plain played baritone. Johnny Coles played trumpet. Clifford Brown played trumpet. And we had a trombone player. I can't remember his name. And that was the group. And so Louis said, well, I don't have my horn, Pops. Johnny Cole said, well, you can use mine.
Oh.
So he came up. Well, what are we going to play? This is something special. We're not going to play that dance music. Sweet Georgia Brown. And we started off, and it wound up with Louis Armstrong and Clifford Brown and a so-called kind battle. Wound up taking four bars exchanges. He played four bars. Cliff would play four bars. Now, styles were completely different. But both of these guys were geniuses. Mm-hmm. Louis, when he played in his realm at the top peak of his ability. And when Clifford played, he played in his style. It was absolutely fantastic, Tom. I wish you could have heard it. One of those things that it's a pity it wasn't recorded.
Mm-hmm.
And Pops, Louis Armstrong, he could play. Armstrong said if he had been born like a generation later with Diz, you've been right up there with Diz and Miles and all the other great trumpet players and that style.
Mm-hmm.
But he played the heck out of his style. He was fantastic. Now, in the beginning, as an amateur, I saw him as old-fashioned, and I didn't want to have anything to do with the likes of Louis Armstrong. But when I became mature enough, I realized that this guy was a genius. Louis Armstrong, that's right. Incredible.
It's amazing.
And when things like that come along, you don't throw Louis Armstrong away. It's like putting new bottles on the shelf. You move the older bottles to the side a little bit, and you put that bottle there, and you keep adding the bottles, the newer ones and the newer ones. But you don't throw it away. And he was not to be thrown away.
Oh.
Yeah, that night, I'll never forget it, Tom. I'll never forget it. Incredible.
Yeah, wow. I've never heard of that. And I studied my Louis Armstrong history deeply. I listen to Armstrong. I try to listen to one track at least by Armstrong every day. I found so much joy and life affirmation in Louis Armstrong's music. But you know, like you say, and it's so often said about Armstrong that one needs to mature to appreciate Louis Armstrong.
Absolutely.
There's so much baggage around the image. People discard it, old-fashioned Uncle Tom, all kinds of notions
like
that.
Yeah, Uncle Tom thing attached to him.
Mm.
You know, showing the teeth and the handkerchief on the valves and wiping his brow. But that was just, he was a happy-go-lucky guy with extremely amount of talent.
Yeah,
he was in those pictures with Bing Crosby and the stars and, Armstrong was popular, extremely popular.
Mm-hmm.
He might have been more popular in Europe than here.
Mm-hmm.
Incredible.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the key to an understanding, though, is what you said about yourself. When you got mature enough, it was time to pay attention and respect Louis Armstrong. Because, you know, there's room on the shelf for everyone. You talked about moving the bottles over a little bit. And when it comes to art, to music, there's room for everyone. You know, one other thing there's so many things in the book, and I know we need to let you go, but you talk about working with Herbie Fields, and lo and behold, who's the pianist on the band?
Remember
but
Herbie
Fields and Bill Evans.
Right, that's where I met Bill, and he was the corniest piano player I ever heard.
The corniest.
Corny.
Right.
When he pat his feet, he had both feet together side by side and moved the heels up and down like he was pumping the organ.
No kidding.
And he bounced up and down on the piano seat, and he played like Milt Buckner, who used to play with Lionel Hampton.
Sure.
With Bach chords up at the top of the piano. Corny.
You said he was a classic nerd.
A nerd. And years went by, and I went to Vanguard. and I heard him play. I couldn't believe it. And when he cut off, I said, Bill, what happened? And his answer to me was, you can't keep playing the same old stuff all the time. Yeah, I got to love his style. Oh, did I ever love Bill? Not the first Bill.
Right.
But the second Bill I fell in love with. Mm-hmm. He came to my house once for something, my apartment something, and it was dinner time. And while we were eating, he played piano music for us while we were having dinner.
Oh, wow. That's beautiful.
I love Bill Evans in Plainfield, New Jersey.
Mm-hmm. Yep. You talk about an encounter with him on the sidewalk in which he related something about the great bassist Scott LaFaro. I think that's kind of part of the lore about Bill Evans, but can you recall that?
Yes. I said, Bill, how are things going? He said, Scott is driving me crazy. I said, what is it? He said he won't play 1, 2, 3, 4. Boom, 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 boom. He's always playing these other things. And you know what? He locked into what he was doing.
Sure.
And that album he did live at the Vanguard, My Foolish Heart and some of the other things he played, fantastic. And Scott, I never even got to see him to know what he looked like. One of the big regrets.
Yep.
It's fantastic what he was doing.
Sure. What
was that song he played? Da, 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 da. I can't think of the name of the tune.
Glorious Step?
Gorgeous. Not Glorious Step. What was the name of that thing?
Waltz for Debbie.
Yes. What he played on there, the notes that he played on those chords, the other notes to the chord, and it set up a pattern. Absolutely beautiful. Beautiful. I loved it. And Bill came to love it, too.
Oh, yeah.
In the beginning, he just didn't understand. It was something new. When people encounter something new, they're afraid of it, or they sometimes, or they back away from it, or they hate it. But then there are other people that go for it, go out for it. Jeff Keyser did a recording on Whisper Not once. That recording was so out there, it went beyond Mars.
Now, who made that one?
Jeff Keyser.
Oh, Jeff Keyser.
And he called me and said, he sent the album to me. He said, what did you think of it? I know it was kind of out there. And you know what my answer was? I said, I loved it. Really? I said, yes. Like Steven Spielberg thinks. Why does everything always have to be the same? That's why I fell in love with him. Yeah, why does everything always have to be the same? There are new things out there. There are things to be discovered. You have to have the aptitude. You have to have the determination. You have to have the curiosity. Yeah, what's behind that door? What will I see if I can open it? Yeah. It's an adventure.
Yeah. You mentioned Steven Spielberg, and you enjoy a kind of iconic status in his movie called The Terminal with Tom Hanks. And, you know, I know that it involves the famous photograph, the Great Day in Harlem photograph. How did that happen? What was that like for you to be?
I couldn't believe it. When the office called me, I was in Europe and said, Steven Spielberg's office called today and wanted to know, would you be interested in a film with Tom Hanks? And I told them no. And they couldn't understand why. Well, prior to that, I'd gotten many calls to do a commercial on camera. And when you show up, it's like a cattle call. It's like a herd of cattle there. And I never got picked. I never got one of those commercials. Woody Allen called me, his office, twice. I didn't get picked for that. And I said, no, I don't have time for that. And then the office said, no, he asked for you specifically. I said, really? So when I talked with him, I still didn't know what it was about. He wanted to send the script to me and wanted me to go to some studio downtown Manhattan and read these lines on camera, and they would send them back to him to see what it looked like. And I did. And when it was over, they were very satisfied, but they read the physiognomy of my face, the expression on my face, and they said, what's wrong? I said, a musician wouldn't say it quite like that. And they said, well, let's do it again, and you do it the way a musician would do it, the situation. And we did. And they sent both of them to him, and and that was the one they went with, the one that I thought the musician would do. And so, yeah, I met him in Montreal, where they're going to shoot this part. I didn't know what the name of the picture was going to be. I didn't know anything. Mm-hmm. But he wanted to use my group, you know, the piano, bass, and drums. Mike LaDon,
Carl Allen,
and
Buster Williams. Was it
Buster Williams
or Peter
right.
Washington? Okay.
So we all went to. I can't remember yesterday. Hear me stumbling. So I went to Montreal, and I came down for dinner in a hotel, my wife and I. And then a few minutes later, he came down with his entourage, and I said to my wife, I said, oh, there he is. And they sat where they were sitting, and she says, well, why don't you go over? I said, well, I don't really know him, and it seems like he's in a business situation. I said, I'd better wait. So eventually, one person got up, the secretary, I guess, and came over and asked me, was I Benny Golson? I said, yes. And she said, Stephen wants to speak with you. And I pushed the chair back and get ready to get up. She says, oh, no. He'll come over here. So I sat, and he came over, and there was no chair for him to sit. And I'm looking around for, where can I get a chair? He said, oh, no, don't worry about it. And he knelt down on one knee, and he started to talk like old time. Wow. We got into the conversation that got so deep. I said, Stephen, would you stand up? I promise if I ever met you, I was going to do something. And he stood up, and I stood up, and I kissed him. And he fell out. He couldn't do it. But he was telling me about the delicatessen that his mother had. He wanted to give it up, and how USC told him he didn't have any talent. They canceled him out.
Wow.
And all he was going to, like old friends. Later on, I told him, I bet you USC is glad. Sorry they dropped you. He said, oh, no. He said, I'm on the board of directors there now.
Oh, yeah.
And I decide who gets money every year. And we both laughed. And then he told me, I said, well, why did you happen to come up with this this picture, Great Day in Harlem, and I'm on the picture, and you're choosing me. He said, when I was in college, I used to come and see you. He said, and my favorite thing that you've ever written is I Remember Clifford.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how it started, and we became friends. Then I met Tom when we started to shoot, and he's just ordinary. And Stephen did something that no director ever did in all of my writing assignments in Hollywood. You know what he did?
What?
When his wife, Kate Catshaw, when she came on the scene, he stopped everything, brought her up on the stage to set where I was with Tom, and introduced me to her or her to me.
Mm-hmm.
No producer ever did anything like that. Mm-hmm. And she's just like him, nothing to prove, just ordinary.
Right.
And while we were filming, in between the takes, Tom leaned over to me and said, Benny, you don't know what a great privilege this is for me to be doing this scene with you. And I'm like, is he kidding? Tom Hanks? Elated at doing a scene with me, he should know how crazy I am, what I'm going through. And we became friends. And so we emailed each other. In fact, we're going to do something together the end of the year, November, maybe December, in between pictures in Southern California. And we're not quite sure exactly what it is, but he'll be talking and I'll be playing. And he's a regular guy, just a regular guy. And I met his wife. She came and performed here at the Carlisle, and he was in town, and we all hung out. And first thing she did when she saw me was come and embrace me and give me a big kiss.
Oh, wow.
Just ordinary people. He sent me a DVD, yeah, and he had on it. Just a note said, check this out. And I put the DVD on, and it was his youngest son who was playing guitar in high school with the high school band, and they were playing Killer Joe.
Oh.
Yeah, he's a great guy. I love him to death. He and Steven, they're the same. They're just like you and me talking in them. That's the way they are.
Mm.
You never knew they was famous. Never. Incredible.
Oh, that's beautiful. I get that impression from the occasional interview I see of Tom Hanks on television.
He knows a million people
that
time, and he was in town, and his wife was staying at the Carlisle.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that guy knew everybody in the place.
Sure.
Incredible. That's the kind of guy he is.
Well, Benny, it's really been a pleasure speaking with you today, and man, I could hang with you all day long. The conversation has been really enjoyable.
Well, that's reciprocal. I could hang with you, and I could hang with you because you asked the right questions. You didn't ask me how old was I when I started playing, who was my favorite saxophone player, who did I take lessons with. Linguistic arithmetic. You didn't go to that room. Thank you.
Oh, well, you're welcome. And thank you. You've been a great teacher and inspiration for me for many years, and I love your music and the sound of your horn and the cats you play with, too. And this new record is delightful. It's got a nice title, Horizon Ahead. Benny, I know you're 87 years old this year. You sound like the picture of youth. What's the horizon look like for Benny Golson today?
I don't know, but I always want to find out because one never arrives at the horizon. Yeah. It's fantastic. And your knowledge, it seemed like you might have been the one who made me famous.
Oh, man, that's a beautiful compliment. Thank you very much, Benny. And I wish you well. I look forward to having I haven't seen you for a little while, but I hope there's another opportunity soon to see you on a bandstand around New York or up maybe at the Regatta Bar or Scholars in Boston or...
one of the venues. Time would not be so unkind as to keep us apart indefinitely.
You're a charmer, too, Mr. Golson.
Nice talking to you, Tom.
Likewise.
Thank you so much.
Yep. Okay. God
Take
bless.
Care now.
You too. Bye bye.
Bye bye. Thank you.
me.